Ma mai előadónk Johannes Hoyer úr, a Bergeni Múzeum, a Bergeni Egyetem információs és kommunikációs koordinátor munkatársa. Hoyer úr norvég nyelvet és irodalmat tanult, történelmet és antropológiát, újságíróként és tanárként dolgozott, és ezután kezdett tudománykommunikációval foglalkozni. Előadása két részből fog állni. Egyrészt bemutatja az Atlanti-óceáni hátság élővilágának feltérképezésére indított nemzetközi kutatói kooperációnak az eredményeit. Ez egy nagyon látványos és nagyon izgalmas előadásnak ígérkezik. És az előadásának másik részében pedig arról fog beszélni, ami az ő igazi szakterülete, és ez pedig azok az eszközök a tudománykommunikációban, amivel egy ilyen nagy, komplex és meglehetősen szakmai tudományos kutatási projektnek az eredményeit be lehetett illeszteni, nem csak az oktatásba, nem csak a kutatásba, de különböző laikus diskurzusokba, és úgy általában a társadalmi nyilvánosság egészébe is. A Bergeni Múzeum a Minden Tudás Egyeteme együttműködő partnere a 2.0-as program megvalósításában. Az a partner, akitől a Minden Tudás Egyeteme 2.0 projekt a tudománykommunikációs know-how-nak a részleteit igyekszik ellesni, eltanulni. Átadom a szót Johannes Hoyernek. Johan, please, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Well, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for your introduction. And I'm delighted to come here to Budapest to, first of all, cooperate and to follow our cooperation and to share our experience with the Mareko project. And it has been a fantastic project, and I think it's especially interesting to present a project that is far out from continental Europe. It's far out in the sea, in the deep Atlantic, down to 4,000 meters. My talk will be, first I will talk the main part of it, I will talk about the project, and then also about the second part, a little bit about the communication project also. But I think that you will find that the project is so interesting, so I will use most of my time on this. Well, I have 45 minutes, so I start now. Well, Deeper than light is an expression we use for this project. Is we go down in the sea, and it's the deeper than light expression we use. It has been used for a book about this project, and it's also been used by an exhibition, traveling international exhibition called Deeper than Light. So I use that as a title. This project is, of course, as you know, led by Norway, but it's an international project. In the decade of from 1919 to year 2000, there was a big international research program, which initiative was from the Sloan Foundation, an American foundation, which started a big international research project about the stars. And the Sloan Foundation, finished in year 2000, and the Sloan Foundation decided they wanted to do another one for 10 years, global research project called the Census of Marine Life. One of these projects is Mareko. And Mareko, at that time, in the beginning of 2000, Norway was building the most modern research vessel, GeoSAR, and Norway applied for doing a study along the mid-Atlantic ridge, in the middle of Atlantic, and they said that they wanted to use the vessels for 2 months. And to have a cruise for 2 months, it's quite... it costs a lot, And because the Norwegian state said that they want the use of the money for that, we got in charge of this program, which is a study of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. I will come back to that. But there are, in this project, 16 participating countries. The main countries, of course, are around the North Atlantic. It's UK, it's Germany, it's Russia, it's Iceland, it's Portugal. It's a very important partner, and France. I think that's the, and United States. As you know, let me see. We have the pointer here. So. As you know, you see on the map, on the upper map, the globe is, you have the place of the globe, and along the plates, of the continental plates, there are deep sea ridges. And you see the mid-Atlantic ridge that divides the Atlantic Sea, Atlantic Ocean. You have the European plate and the African plate and the American plates on the west side. This is a huge, huge mountain chain, deep sea chain, a sort of Himalaya in the deep. And this MARECO project is an international study of the ecosystem of organisms living along the northern part of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, down to 4,000 meters. As you see, from south of Iceland down to the Azores. In the middle of that area, there is a huge canyon called Charley Gibbs Fracture Zone, which is special interest because it's divided the ridge, and it's a border between the northern water masses and the more southern water masses. It's a big canyon where the Gulf Stream of the warm water goes through this big canyon. So that was especially an area which was aim or target of the study. The mission of this, as you see, for studying the ecosystem, it was to describe and understand the patterns of distribution of organisms, the abundance, the richness of how much marine organisms, fish and other animals, and the relationships of the organism inhabiting the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. So MARECO is Mid-Atlantic Ridge Ecosystem. And in this way, also identify ecological processes that cause variability in these patterns. So everyone, when I'm talking about the project, everyone asks, how many new species do you find? Of course, you find new species, but the main targets of the project was to understand the ecosystem, the relationships in that area. Here is the image of the Geo SARS. And the cruise was in 2004, and it was a cruise with, I think it was 16 scientists on two legs, on two stages of the cruise. And there was also one artist and one national documentary photographer and a TV team. So altogether, with the two-leg, two parts of the cruise, that was 32 scientists and also a crew of, I think, around 10 people. We also cooperated with a fishing vessel. This is a modern Norwegian fishing vessel which were accompanying the Geo SARS on the second part. It's called Loran, and it's very modern because it's a long line fishing boat which has a line which can go down to 5,000 meter. And 5,000 meter is a very long way. To put this in a context, last time there was an expedition in this area was 100 years ago. Actually, it was in 1910. That was the first study of the animals in the deep sea animals in the North Atlantic. It was at that time financed by a Scotchman, a Scot, who was financing this Norwegian cruise, and they made tremendous interesting material and they collected, and all this material came to Bergen Museum. And it was interesting because in the end, around 1817, 1880, the scientists thought that there were no life below 200-300 meters. And the 1910, or the deep sea exhibitions in the beginning of the 19th century proved that it, in the 20th century, it proved that it, there were life down to the bottom. Here is the root of the cruise. The leg, we call it the leg, but it's, you see it's from, let me see. On the upper part you see Bergen on the west coast. You know where you put the cursor here? It's that one. It's the middle. Okay? You have it now? Yes. Oh, here it is. Oh, that's good. Here's Bergen on the west coast of Norway, my hometown. And the first part went out and really started the study here at the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. This area, this canyon I told you about, the Charley Gibbs Fracture Zone, where the subpolar front is down here in the summertime, and it, in the wintertime, sorry. And it divides the ridge dramatically. And the leg was down to the source, and then there was the change of a crew and change of a crew of scientists too. And the second part went up again in this area and especially studied the Charley Gibbs Fracture Zone. And back through Aberdeen, back to Bergen. First, how did we work? Technology to go deep sea science is really a hot topic of using the state of art of modern technology. It's like space technology in the deep. So here you see a little bit of images from technology used, and I and here you see a map of the ridge. You know that there were no exact maps on the ridge, so the vessel had to make new maps when they stopped at the station. Under the vessel, there is a multi-beam sonar, which made a new map when the gear and everything were lowered down to the bottom, get down to the bottom, and they prepare the map to see how the terrain, how the ridge was down there. And of course, it was very important because some of the equipment was also used to be a lander on the ridge. And we also used ROVs, that are remote operated submarines. No, it's not man in, but it's it is very important because some of these animals are destroyed when they come up with a trawler or whatever, so they have to. It's important that using the film and cameras are very important. And therefore, the ROVs were very valuable. And this is a lander, as I told you, on the ridge. I have a video from one of the DVDs which tell you a little bit more exactly about the technology.
Just 200 years ago, the deep sea was compared with the barren and lifeless deserts. Deep sea exploration began only about 150 years ago. The naturalists of the first pioneer expeditions discovered life at much greater depths than expected. They brought ashore exciting and weird, real deep sea animals instead of the fantasy beasts created by imagination. Today we have more advanced sampling gears, new observation technology, and powerful research vessels. Methods for laboratory analysis have also been developed greatly. And now we have advanced microscopes and we can do X-ray examination of internal skeletons. We also have DNA techniques to study genetics and evolutionary relationships between animals of the same family or genus. Faced with the challenge of observing and catching animals at great depths in rugged terrain, MarEco adopts the most advanced technology and instruments available. Many technologies are used at the same time from the same vessel. Traditional but electronically monitored fishing gears, optical instruments, echo sounders, benthic landers, moorings, and manned and unmanned submersibles. The research vessel, the GeoSARS, is a flagship among the Norwegian research vessels and was used by an international MarEco team of 60 scientists in 2004. Icelandic, Russian, American, German, and Portuguese vessels have also contributed to the effort. In 2007 to 2009, British and American vessels will conduct further cruises. The MS Loran is one of Norway's best high seas commercial fishing vessels and was chartered to work for MarEco in 2004, deploying deep sea long lines, fish traps, and gill nets. Russian deep-sea research submarines, the Mir-1 and Mir-2, were used for deep dives in 2003. This multi-sampler is mounted on a macro zooplankton trawl, which can then be opened and closed at preset intervals. The Dobo photographic lander releases portions of bait at pre-programmed time intervals. The bait attracts fish and invertebrates, which can then be photographed by the lander camera. The remotely operated vehicle, ROV Bathysaurus, can be used for midwater and seabed exploration using cameras and samplers. Here is a cod in an aquarium being retrieved. The aquarium helps keep specimens in good condition, and it also has an internal digital video camera. The French underwater video profiler is used to map zooplankton and other particulate matter in the water column to 1,000 metres depth. The multinet is a sampler used to collect small organisms in the water column from the surface to approximately 1,000 metres. An acoustic Doppler current profiler, or ADCP, records currents in the deep. This huge trawl is used for catching fish and other organisms at mid-water depths. This CTD profiler measures temperature and salinity in the water column. The grey cylinders collect water samples, and these water bottles are left open when lowered into the water. The operator decides at what depth each bottle is closed.
So this was the repertoire, and you see, just one comment. You know the big trawler there? The biggest one of them was going to collect small plankton in the sea. You could put, it was so big that you could put the whole Eiffel Tower in the width of it was broader than the Eiffel Tower, the whole trawl. So to catch small planktons from the sea. Well, back to the oceanographic conditions or the topographical conditions in the deep sea along the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. This illustration show that what happens in an ocean basin without a ridge and with a ridge, and you see that. This creates, the topography creates another distribution of the water masses. So the Mid-Atlantic Ridge divides, it's important to see that it divides the animal life in north and south and east and west. And as I told you, the Charlie Gibbs fracture zone is very important. And also the hydrofrontal zones. So we will see that in the results from the project. The project was organized and divided to that different research groups were studying different animal groups, and also organized in this way that some were working with an animal or life in the upper layers, in the surface layers, and some in the twilight zone, the zone where there's a little light, and some were really working in the dark zone, from around 300 meters and below, down to 4,000 meters. So I will just give Nikki, the lovely voice of Nikki King, just to tell a little bit also about the whales, for example, in the surface waters. That was one of the important topics of the...
Whales are mammals and comprise animals ranging from small dolphins and porpoises to big baleen whales. The blue whale is the largest animal that has ever lived on Earth. Baleen whales have a sieve-like structure in the upper jaw that they use to filter zooplankton from the water. Mariko has observed and tagged baleen whales, including sei, fin, humpback and blue whales. Being tagged with a satellite transmitter would kill a human, but to a huge whale it feels more like a mosquito bite. Whales and dolphins appear to use the mid-Atlantic ridge as a travel route. Toothed whales are generally smaller and they prey mainly on fish and squid. The exception is the huge sperm whale with its massive head and long lower jaw carrying two rows of large teeth. The sperm whale is a great diver and it can capture squid and fish as deep as 2,000 meters below the surface.
The whales, they are, of course, the predators, and they are, some of the whales, I have to tell that, are going down, as Nikki said, down to 2,000 meters. I don't have it here, but we had an echogram from the GeoSAS, where you can see a line of a humpback whale going down 2,000 meters. You can see it on the echogram. A line where the animal goes straight down 2,000 meters and stay there, up again. And an important thing that she also said, that the whales, or the big whales in the North Atlantic, they're using the whole basin. So then someday they are in a honeymoon in outside Spain, and then they want to go out over to Newfoundland or Canada, and they use the ridge as a sort of snack bar. They stop because that is important, the ridge, for the life along the ridge. If we go further down the layer, in the twilight zone, I've picked out also a little presentation of some of the, not the fish, but the jellyfishes of different kinds, the wonderful, beautiful jellyfishes.
Jellies consist mainly of water and include a variety of distantly related animals like jellyfishes, comb jellies, sea butterflies, salps, larvations and arrowworms. Most jellies are passive drifters or plankton. Some jellies are predators on small fish and zooplankton, using stinging structures or sticky tentacles for their prey capture. Others filter water to feed on phytoplankton and other small particles. Many of the jelly-like animals remain undescribed, and there is still so much that we do not know about them, as they have a tendency to collapse or to be severely damaged when caught by standard sampling gears. Deep-sea jellies can therefore only be studied by cameras and submersibles. The deep-sea Siphomedusae atolla typically lives at depths of 500 to 1,000 metres, but can be found down to 5,000 metres. It feeds on zooplankton, which is captured by the tentacles. When disturbed, it can produce a long-lasting, spectacular light show. Medusae are generally pelagic predators. Often, jellyfish segregate into specific layers in the water column. In the open oceans, they are especially abundant at 300 to 600 metres water depth. The small Agenura grimaldii shows the red colour so common among deep living creatures. The colour makes the medusa less visible in the dim blue light. Comb jellies, or tenophores, are gelatinous animals which are equipped with 8 rows of locomotive hairs, or cilia, along the body. The rainbow-coloured light is produced by diffraction of incoming light and is therefore not bioluminescence. This species, Bolinopsis infundibulum, captures zooplankton with the extended lobes.
Well, that was the jellies. As she said, it's just modern technology has done it available that we can see this through the images and through the ROVs. And you saw that, well, how the conditions of the jellies were if you took it out with the trawler and traditional gears. Then we go down to the dark zone, and that is, of course, by the public. People are very interested in all these strange fishes. They look very awful. Remember that most of them are in this size. But you see, you can see on the proportion of the fishes or how they look that what is important, that is to see or hide, eat, or find a mate. Reproduction and to be eat or to prevent from being eaten. Let's see some of these bathypelagic fishes. Bathypelagic means down at the bottom.
There are approximately 30,000 species of fishes, but just a few are adapted to life at extreme depths. In the bathypelagic zone, we find the strangest adaptations to low food availability and life in eternal darkness. The density of animals of the same species is very low, so finding a mate can be a challenge. Deep-sea anglerfish have bioluminescent lures on the tip of their fishing rod, which is actually a modified dorsal fin ray. These fish are ambush predators waiting for their prey to come close enough to be sucked into their gigantic armoured mouths.
Okay, we found a female anglerfish, Melanocetus johnsoni. This fish shows one of the adaptations to the deep, which is to have a really huge mouth. So you can tell that this fish is almost all mouth. And the theory is that when you live in an environment that doesn't have a lot of food, you want to have a really big mouth so that you can eat almost anything you see. So this gives it a very large spectrum of prey size.
Pelican eels have huge, expandable mouths that they keep open like an upside-down umbrella to catch sinking prey. As in the mesopelagic zone, species with armoured heads and gigantic teeth occur. Just like the fangtooth, Anoplogaster cornuta. Common features of fishes living in total darkness are a dark colour, large mouth, and long pointed teeth. It is vital to minimise the chance of missing a meal. The appearance may be disturbing, but the size of these fishes is rather modest. Most of them are less than 20 centimetres long.
Well, I just have to tell you one story, because behind all these fishes, there are lots of stories. For example, the anglerfish, you know, Tracy was told about with this fishing rod. This is the perfect story of love. You know that the female fish is big, and the male fish is very tiny. And as you see, most of these fishes are very old, actually, because it's difficult to find a mate. And when the male or the female anglerfish find a mate, or the male find the female anglerfish, you just do one thing. He goes into and bite in the skin of the female fish, the big fish, and they grow together. And they stay there for the rest of their life together. And he will do his man's job during, and they reproduce lots of babies and so on, and they will stay there. So that's the way of doing this, to have the reproduction of that fish. And as it is said that most of the fish, many of the fishes, have been quite old. So, for example, a fish you will see later on called orange roughy, that could be up to 150 years old. So that's the type of adaptation, because you have to secure your children, to get children. And here is the orange roughy. So this story tells one, the deep sea fishes tells wonderful stories, but different types of life stories. Because this is under extreme conditions. We are down at 3,000-4,000 meter. It's a temperature of around 3 Celsius degrees, and an enormous pressure, of course. So it's happening. What's important is eat, reproduce, and prevent being eaten. And I won't come to that, but one of the things that are very important is, of course, to be prevent or to be attracted for a male. Also using in this area of known light, bioluminescence is very important. And also to use in camouflage. We just dropped it, I think. No. Let me see. This study the project, what has it, if we sum it up, what sort of results have we got? In 3 weeks ago, it was the big summing up of the Census of Marine Life in London. And we prepared the main results of the project. And if I put that into 5-6 points, the first thing, the project, which has then started in 2004, have documented around 1,000 species that lives along the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. 40 species has now been described as new designs. That means that they have also prepared the publications. Perhaps there will be more, but it will be very astonishing if there hadn't been any new. There are lots more to discover. The third thing is that the midwater and bottom fauna, life varies according to depth, latitude, and oceanographic fronts. And it is also important that this research project has documented that it seems that the animals have gathered around the top of the, along the ridge slopes and at the top. So it's easy, for example, for the whales to eat it. And also the heights abundance, which was a hypothesis, it's a sort of documented that the heights abundance occurs in the hydrographical frontal zones between the different water masses of different temperatures. And we also have documented that the species are a little bit slightly differ on eastern and western slopes. So there are Americans and Europeans. And It also documented that many of the animals are, which are reproductively isolated populations, that they are a population which are just at the ridge, even though they have their more same part along the continental slopes. Well, we've been studying this for nearly 10 years. It has an important scientific, provided scientific result, but has it also provided other results? I will come back to the communication results, but does it have any impact on politics or international management of the seas? This project has done that because in this area, this is non-regulated area. These fishes, some of them are very vulnerable, and it's easy to that they could be extinct. And it's easy to fish them out of the system. So the results from the Morocco project has been used in the Fishery Commission of the East Atlantic, called NEAFC, which has decided to close areas for deep sea fisheries. There was also, I think it was 1.5 months ago, there was a meeting in the Oslo-Paris Commission, which regulates the marine environment in the deep sea, and they have made some of this area protected, marine protected areas. And you see, these areas, especially for bottom fisheries, are rather big areas. And some is near the Charlie Gibbs fracture zone. But do we know? Have we got all the results? Have we got all the knowledge of the rich? Of course not. I'll show you this picture because these are some strange tracks at the bottom, found at 2,082 meters. By the ROV Batosaurus, it's called, sent down from GeoSAS. We don't know what it is. It's a theory. It could be a sort of crustacean or crab or something, but we don't know. And there's no man being down there. Well, I told you about that this is a part of Census of Marine Life. And Census of Marine Life have 25 more projects approximately. So just to tell you a little bit about the results from the summing up of this huge international research project or a program, after 10 years exploration of 2,700 marine scientists from 80 nations. The one conclusion is, of course, that life in oceans are richer, more connected, and more impacted than we thought before. A lot of new species have been discovered, and that also detected marine highways and rest stops mapped. As you see, also in the Morocco project, but some of the other projects have tagged different animals, like whales, salmon, sharks, and find out their routes, where they travel in the oceans. And of course, we have documented diminished species and abundance, and also made a big global map of addresses of species. That's going into a big database called OBIS. Well, then I have 10 minutes more to tell a little bit about also communication. Since we are in the setting of our project, the cooperation is also not telling about the science, but also telling about the science to the public or to different other target group outside the science community. Well, we made a scientific science communication program when it started. And we started with the communication work the same time as the scientific program started. We made a communication plan which follow the steps of the science plan. We started with the field work, with a planning phase and the field work, and then a phase of stage of results. And our idea was that we wanted to invite the public to a scientific journey. A journey down in the deep, and a journey together with scientists to see what happens, how scientists are working. To discover deep sea life, and using the state art of technology, not only in science, but use the state art of technology also in communication. And of course, the new technology has opened an unknown world where you now are able to go down and to film and get all these films and videos or images. Our aim was to get public attention and international focus, to motivate and recruit, especially among young people, and also create knowledge for sustainable management, as I've told you. The group of politicians then. So we've done something in that area. As I said, integrated with science from day one. One thing that was important, we want not only to speak to our heads, but also speak to our hearts. Therefore, it was important to show all these animals and to get people's imaginations and feelings of how the nature is, the brutalness of nature and the wonders and beautifulness of nature. So our main hypothesis was not talk to our head first, but first attract attention and interest, and then people will be motivated to knowledge. And one of our ideas was also to keep attention over years and stay in the limelight. I stay here in the limelight. We started in 2003. So, as you see, the crews have created, or not only the GeoSARS crews, there has been other smaller crews from different countries, and all has created very good visual presentations with photos, art, and film. Because the artists following were doing a lot of interesting work. And this was the basis for the overall outreach activities. So our target group was international public. It was especially children and young people around the Northern Atlantic. That's a big group. And decision makers. Our goal was to create a variety of activities and products, to attract visitors and web activities and readers, and to have international media coverage, and create a school network and educational programs. This is our website, and I just focus also on one thing that was important. The website was established in the beginning, and during the cruise we had a so-called ship-to-shore portal where you could follow, it's a sort of blog, where you could follow the cruise, and where the scientists daily reported with images and text from the crews. David Shale, he is a former BBC photographer, working with, perhaps you know, it's a famous series called Blue Planet. And we hired him, and he was very important, his images, as you have seen lots of times, in communicating the project. Back to 1920. We had with us an artist, which I will tell you a little bit more about. But in 1910, they didn't have any photos, but they had illustrators. This man was sitting in Bergen in 40 years drawing fishes. And it was, so we wanted in also in this project to tell a little bit about his wonderful drawings, illustrations from the 1910 cruise, which we also have used in our communication. And this is the artist, a very famous Norwegian artist, which followed the first part of the cruise, and he made his impressions of how these animals are. And this is a little bit about, we had very high media coverage, especially in 2004-05. And of course, we made various prints like this. So you can see here, this is a poster in 9 languages. We tried to work internationally. Not in Hungarian. It was not in Hungarian, but mainly in languages from the participant countries. Yeah. And we have made videos and films. And there's a TV documentary, which has now been made by the Norwegian Broadcasting Corporation, which has now been sent for second times in Norway. It have been sent, transmitted to 5-6 other countries. Then we had a school network. We have a special learning zone on the web, and we had a net day where there's students all around in different countries could talk to them, to ask questions to scientists in the projects. And we have different kinds of books. And the most interesting thing that this project, this has been so fascinating that people have come to us, artists, musicians, and others who want to use this material. This is a computer game which has just been launched. It's a part of a doctoral thesis at the Institute of Media Science at the University of Bergen, how to use new media and a play like this and using scientific knowledge. So this is the story about Mara and Orange Ruffy. And we have had different events, like this show in Norway in 2009, where we gathered 700 Norwegian students, followed listened to some of the talks from the scientists, accompanied with musicians who had made music to this project. So artists have come to us. There have been jazz musicians. We have CDs which are called Underwater, which has made special stories about special music related to the project, and sculptures too. So just to sum up, what was important for us in our communication was that we wanted to stimulate that science is also related to creativity, intuitions, and experiments. And in some way, I'm nearly finished. this cooperation between art and science, what is the difference between art and scientist and an artist? And what are the similarities? We find that this is very interesting because this, to be a good scientist, you have to be creative. You have to find in new ways, things from different points of views. So it was very interesting to see how the artists also communicated with the scientists. And that has been one of the big points from other Sensors of Marine projects also, that art is important in communicating also science. Just to stop, we have made an international traveling exhibit called Deeper Than Light, which has now been in 10 countries. It's in Denmark now. We have had the pleasure to be in Washington at the Smithsonian in this spring. And of course, we hope to go to Budapest in next year. Here's some images from the exhibition. It shows the specimens, the art, and the images. It has been a successful project. We have won several prizes. Also the Descartes Prize in Science Communication in EU in 2004. So, to conclude the communication part, I've concluded that in 6 points. It was important for us to utilize the exploration aspect because people are interested in exploration of knowledge and related to if you can invite them on a journey. We've tried to make synergy between activities and to combine science and art and to be inclusive and involving partners. Everyone who is interested, please come to us and use our work or use our project. Planning, of course, is important, And perhaps the most important thing, try to make a good cooperation between a scientist and a communicator or the outreach team from the beginning. It's not like the scientist will go at the end and say, do something for me at the end. No, we have to do it together from the beginning. This is it. I'll end with a jelly painted by Ernulf Opdahl, the painter. And these are our web addresses for the Bergen Museum, the Marekko, and the Census of Marine Life. Thank you so far.
Sir, thank you for this fascinating talk. És itt most megragadnám az alkalmat, hogy átadjam a közönségnek a szót, van időnk néhány kérdésre. Annyit kérek önöktől, hogy azt tartsák, ne feledkezzenek meg róla, hogy Hoyer úr nem tengerbiológus, tehát nem biztos, hogy minden halas kérdésre válaszolni fog. But you must know much about fish by now, right? Kérdés, hogy kinek van kérdése. Tessék.
Kérdésem a professzor úrhoz. Tetszett említeni, a DNS technikával is dolgoztak. A DNS technikával a tenger alján lévő állatokat kutatták-e, hogy mikor alakultak ki, és összehasonlítva a földi, szárazföldi állatokkal, melyik állatcsoport jött létre korábban, a vízi, tehát amit betetszett mutatni, vagy a szárazföldi állatcsoport jött létre korábban. Második kis kérdésem, az előadásban látott állatok, védett állatok ma, mert azt tetszett említeni, hogy védett terület, de védett állatok is, mert az ember, csupa nagybetűvel, a saját fenntartása érdekében mindent átalakít, és nem nézi azt, hogy védett terület, vagy nem védett terület, mert ha neki kell a túléléset, akkor felhasználja. Köszönöm szépen.
Shall I answer that?
Okay. Yes, please do. And one announcement I have to make. Azokra a kérdésekre, amikre itt most nem kapnak választ, azokat kérjük, hogy küldjék el az infókukat mindentudás.hu e-mail címre, és azokat továbbítjuk a megfelelő szakembereknek, és e-mailen megpróbáljuk kideríteni a választ. Tehát, hogyha egy olyan válasz hiányzik majd, amit itt nem tudunk összerakni, akkor e-mailen megpróbáljuk megtalálni a választ.
Okay, regarding the genetics or the DNA analysis, of course, this was done not at the bottom. It was done in the laboratories, and it's still working. Scientists are working with this material. It's an enormous material, which is now at the Bergen Museum or is sent around the world to different specialists. And I have to say one thing, that of course, DNA analysis is very important. But the other thing which is perhaps also very important, very many of the scientists here are taxonomists. And taxonomy is describing an animal, and is in, especially in Western Europe and in Norway, it is a dying topic among scientists, but it has been very important to use old-time taxonomy. So special also from a Russian scientist has been provided a lot of this. But of course, all this work is done with the material or with the organisms come at home when you start this work, not in the sea. Your second question was that regarding marine protected areas, that has just been decided as a result of this, the new data from among this project. So we'll see what happens. Of course, control in the mid-Atlantic water is very difficult. We know it's difficult to control overfishing along the coast of Norway, So I totally agree. It's a big task, but it's a start. It's a start to regulate, get international agreements on protected areas or a regulation of fisheries, bottom of the deep sea fishes.
Kérdés. Amíg gondolkodnak, fölteszek én. I have a question for you.
Yeah.
I'm really fascinated by you didn't talk too much about that, but I know that you have a fascinating school program, and you work with lots of schools, lots of children in this program. I wonder if you are able to track how these children do, what they do with this knowledge acquired here later in their lives. Do you have any experience on how it changes kids' life when they get into such a close contact with such an interesting project?
That was a difficult question. But I'll tell you one story. I got an email in 2005 from a mother of a boy living in a small town in Norway. She sent me an email and said, our son has seen all these fantastic material. I wonder, is there any exhibition? Can we see more of this in Bergen? Can we go by train over to Bergen? Because he is now starting to study marine biology. He wants to do that. So I said, oh, we have one. We have managed one person at least. from this, the school program, of course, we wanted to have more resources to work with it. But there has been a school network, especially in the three first year, there was a school network organized in a EU program called Comenius, where different schools from France, UK, Norway, Lithuania, Portugal, of course, were working. But interesting thing that not everyone was working with marine biology. Some was working with this stuff in geography, and some with this in English, and some in art. And we wouldn't decide that you should just work with this in biology. So this makes inspiration in different ways. So our main aim is to create an interest for the wonders and exploration and the wonders of life, of nature, and the importance of keep it in some ways.
Egy pillanat, a mikrofont a tolmácsképén.
Köszönöm, professzor úr, hogy a kelet és a nyugati lejtőkön különböző populációk vannak. Ezt meg lehet fogalmazni, hogy mi a különbség a két populáció között, vagy egyáltalán a két élőhely között, és mit a különbségek, tehát mik a természeti különbségek, például a hőmérséklet, vagy egyéb különbségek vannak, és miben nyilvánul meg, vagy ez csak az elszigeteltség miatt van a különbség?
That was a professional question. I can answer a little generally about it. It is not like that there are different species, but there are different variations of species between East and West. I think that's the main conclusion. But of course, it's not the ridges, the slopes on the western and eastern side aren't so different, but I think it's important first of all because of the temperature and also the distribution of the water masses that makes different life conditions, which also can due to different adaptations of animals. But it's not a very big difference between East and West, but you see there are some other differences in the patterns of variation in East and West. And but perhaps even more between north and south. And that is, of course, that you have organisms which are adapted to more cold water than warm water. It's in this.
In the northern Atlantic, you're saying there is in that circle.
Yes, in the middle of that circle, in the northern part of it's at the Charlie Gibbs fracture zone. I think if you go straight out from Ireland, in the middle of the sea, then you're in that area.
How much time did you spend on the sea?
I didn't go to the sea.
Okay, and the crew.
At the crew, yeah. It was this. The cruise was 2 months. So the first leg, the first part, was 1 month from Bergen down to the Azores. And then they changed, Scientifica and the crew of the vessels and so on, and 1 month back. So it was a 2 month cruise. But more than that, there have been cruises, especially there's a vessel from UK called James Cook, which is even more modern. It's like Jules Haas. It's the same. It has been built by the same firm. And they have been to the, especially Charlie Gibbs fracture zone, in two cruises around, altogether, I think, a couple of months also. Later, and the latest was when in 2009.
Do they go back?
Yeah, yeah. So they have continued the Mareko project, and they have an affiliated project called EcoMar, which is a daughter of Mareko. But they are also summing up this, so it's part of Mareko.
I have one last question, and if the audience permits me, I would like to close with this question, the session, hogyha megengedik, akkor ezzel a kérdéssel zárnám az előadást. Let's talk about some financial matters. How was the budget divided between actual scientific work out on the sea and the outreach program? And do you think that the outreach program share was enough, or it could have been better?
It was too much. No, it wasn't. No, first of all, about finance. This project, as told about this census of marine life, they didn't finance the science. They financed the infrastructure. They financed the networking, the workshops, and all these things, and also the network of outer communication in some way. So we got a little bit, not so much, but we made our communication plan, and we got a start sum of money to start with working with this different communication project. But for example, this exhibition, this is very expensive. So we had sponsors from the Norwegian Foreign Ministry to one of the big technology companies which had been collaborating with GeoSource and so on. So we had to find special finance for different activities. And the science was, of course, the Norwegian contribution was to have this ship for 2 months. That is a big sum. But then it's financed in traditional way, the other things through different research councils or EU or whatever it was. Yeah. Different parts from different countries.
Thank you very much. Nagyon szépen köszönöm önöknek, hogy itt voltak. Thank you very much for this talk. És remélhetőleg találkozunk majd a Minden Tudás Egyetem a második nagy évfolyamának előadásain is. Köszönöm, hogy itt voltak.
Thank you very much. This has been a pleasure.
Még van egy kérdésem.
Oh, this one more question.
Professor, thank you very much for this excellent presentation. I'm very happy to see this. Logo Minden Tudás Egyeteme once again, such an inspiring presentation as a preface of it. Did you have a target to measure the possible fish stock that is available for future consumption, future catching in the Atlantic Ocean? Or how do you consider the new species that you found as future foodstuff? I like fish very much, and not just me, but Japanese people are so healthy because of eating so many kinds of foodstuff from the sea. Thank you very much.
This is an important question because most of these, nearly all of these species are not big enough for commercial fisheries. That is important. And that is important because they're very vulnerable. If you fish on them, you can distinguish them a little bit because they are so few over so big, in a big space. There is one species, this redfish called orange roughy, that has been fisheries on. It's actually fishing some nations, Russia, and I think also Japan has done that. But it's very easy that this could be extinct. So that was the main reason that they closed some of these areas for bottom fisheries. And most of the commercial fisheries are not in the middle of the Atlantic. They're along the continent.
Thank you.